Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Katie Talento, who is the CEO of All Better Health. However, she is more than the CEO of her employer-sponsored health company. She is a national thought leader in health policy space. And today we're going to explore a wide range of issues related to the employer health space. But before we begin, let me provide a pretty brief, although I feel comprehensive enough, introduction to Ms. Talento. She is one of the more visible policy operators working at the intersection of benefits redesign, competition policy, and alternative care access pathways. Her work explores whether traditional network-centric insurance architectures, big word, which we'll dissect in the course of the conversation, are becoming economically and operationally outdated and what might replace them. And with that, I'd like to welcome Ms. Katie Talento.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Definitely the pleasure is all ours, given just the vast array of experience and knowledge that you possess. Before we jump into the issue at hand on health policy, can you give the audience a brief synopsis of your work in the White House and all the health policy at the executive level that you've amassed over the past few years? Because it is quite impressive and we'll add a lot of context to the conversation.
Yeah, sure. I started life as an epidemiologist, but I lived on Capitol Hill, so I got kind of like sucked in. Everyone who lives in this town eventually gets sucked in. I worked for a bunch of different senators over the years, and from there kind of got dragged into the Trump campaign in 2016 and then into the White House, where I did health policy and some of the values policy for President Trump. For the first 3 years of his first term. And I covered everything in healthcare, like HHS, global, foreign aid, all kinds of healthcare, and DOL and employer-sponsored healthcare, a few VA issues, that sort of thing. If it was healthcare, it was on my plate.
Sure thing. And I think that adds a lot of context to the work that you're doing now. So before we jump into some of the more technical aspects, I want to maybe start at a more fundamental level, kind of understanding the structure of employer health. So when employers get full visibility into the overall health spending, which, as you can attest to, sometimes they really don't, believe it or not, they really start to look at certain economic and operational realities. And to many surprise, feel like the health plan is not exactly what they assumed it to be. So perhaps you can break this down by talking, one, about these employer health plans and some of the common misconceptions that employers have.
Yeah. So, I mean, the majority of employees in the country are covered by a self-funded health plan, which means they're federally regulated instead of being regulated by their states. And they're regulated under a law called ERISA. And that means it's regulated by the Department of Labor and not by HHS and not by your state insurance commission, none of that. And so under ERISA, each plan sponsor, which is an employer, is liable for carrying out its fiduciary obligations to the highest level of strictness under our legal system, meaning that plan sponsor can be held severally and personally liable for being a bad fiduciary. And what does being a good fiduciary mean? It means, under the law, it means you have to manage plan assets solely in the interest of plan beneficiaries. Now, when we think about this, what happens when a plan sponsor, an employer, starts looking under the hood, they're going to see, and they start like just learning a little bit about how healthcare works, they start to see right away that everyone else's interests are being served and not the beneficiaries. So the hospitals are trying to drive up revenue. The PBMs are trying to drive up revenue. The insurance carriers, also the PBMs, usually the same thing, are trying to drive up revenue. The drug makers, revenue. So it's all like all the incentives for a plan sponsor and their plan, all the incentives of every solution that they have running their plan are that you are sicker and higher priced stuff is done to you. And that's the opposite of their goals. In other words, that's the opposite of the interests of the plan beneficiaries that they are required by law to prioritize. And that means that pretty much every contract they have on their plan is illegal. And that is usually what most plan sponsors find out when they start to learn anything about this.
And that's an incredibly powerful statement that I think merits breaking down into a little more detail. Forgive me for the more simplistic nature of the questions, but I think it'll be helpful to develop that train of thought. When you mention the beneficiaries, you're referring to the patients. Now, the notion of looking at them as beneficiaries within a fiduciary framework creates a certain conceptual framework in the mind of the plan itself. And it's not one of those things where it's a distinction without a difference. There are real differences in looking at the plans in that way. Can you maybe go through that cognitive exercise of the impact of looking at healthcare in that way?
Yeah, and it's not just the patients. It's all the enrollees, right, who are paying premiums or at least part of their premiums. So it's them as payers of premiums and losers of compensation, right? They're getting payroll deductions. They're losing what could otherwise be going to cash wages. Instead, it's being diverted to tax-free benefits. And so that's kind of one way to think about it is whether they become patients or not, they're invested in this plan. And their financial interests, as well as their clinical interests, are required by law to be prioritized over all the other interests that are at play in the plan. So where there are conflicts of interest with the plan solutions, like the PBM, the carrier, the GPO, the physicians, the independent practices, the surgery center, like any of those things, where there are conflicts in those relationships between them, each other, like between a carrier and a physician, between or between the vendor or the service provider or the seller of care and the plan sponsor or any other vendor on the plan, anytime there's a conflict of interest where their interests conflict with the interest of the beneficiaries, you have an illegal relationship when it comes to the plan sponsor. And that's only because the plan sponsor is the obvious and overt plan fiduciary. Every fiduciary on the plan has that legal obligation. And one of the things that DOL and the Congress have now started to do is to expose that these prohibited transactions, typically the way the legal framework works is the fiduciary, the plan sponsor, is required to make sure there are no prohibited transactions. And a prohibited transaction is a transaction that occurs pursuant to a conflict of interest, like a conflicted relationship that would undermine the interests of the beneficiaries. Okay. But that makes the employers and those fiduciaries completely responsible. And yet they're like the least equipped to solve that problem. I mean, they're running a car business or whatever, right? And so what DOL and Congress have recently, just this year, done under the new Consolidated Appropriations Act of 26 is say, hey, all you solutions out there, you PBMs, you brokers and benefits consultants, you local charity hospital, any of you carriers, if you are making decisions on the plan, meaning prior authorization decisions, meaning formulary decisions, meaning what's covered, what's not, appeals decisions, if you're making any of those decisions, surprise, you're a fiduciary too. And that means that you better not be a bad one. So if you have conflicts of interest with each other, with the plan, with anything, against the interests of the beneficiaries, you too are engaging in prohibited transactions and you could be held liable severally and personally as a bad fiduciary.
I think that's a very important point to harp on. And I'd like to come from my perspective as a physician, as a clinician, and really start to tease out where these cognitive dissonance arise. Because I think you're bringing up a very important point that many employers don't quite understand. So as a physician, I will refer patients to the hospital, to the surgery center, as you alluded to. Those decisions conceivably are done clinically in what I believe to be the best interest of the patient. However, the misalignment comes in when there starts to become anti-competitive practices or practices that may not be financially viable from a fiduciary standpoint. And I think it's really critical for employers to understand that oftentimes the clinical and the financial are at odds and that you can provide that guidance in a sense where you can frame it to understand this is where the clinical and the financial align. This is where they do not align. And this is where you have to understand your responsibility as a fiduciary and not just as a clinician coordinating care. Can you talk a little bit about how that misalignment gets teased out?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of clinicians are really focused on medical quality, right? And whether like the quality measures that we're being measured against are fair or not or whatever, like where do I think the best quality of care is going to be for this patient? But we forget that part of our job is to protect the billing quality, the fiscal and the fiduciary quality of care. And when you're sending a patient to you, the clinician, who are the most powerful influence on where that patient goes, of course, right? You're using that power in a way that could harm the patient. If you're sending them to a hospital whose interests are utterly aligned against them, especially because that hospital is in a contract with a carrier that is utterly aligned. It's like illegal. It's rife with conflicts of interest and prohibited transactions. There are kickbacks. There are anti-competitive contract provisions. There's all kinds of schemes. And you don't like, you're just trying to like get the guy an MRI, right? you're not trying to hurt this guy, but you can be hurting them when you send them into this Leviathan filled with like just vultures and snake pits. And that really is what you're sending them to when you send them to a hospital because of the nature of the hospital carrier contracts. Now, that's not to say that non-hospital settings are, you know, pure as the driven snow, or that, you know, you can have like private equity owned facilities that are kind of disastrous, and not every physician owned facility is perfection or whatever. But the point is, we need to be thinking about this. We live in this world of imperfect trade-offs, and we need to be thinking that like where I say to go is going to be where that guy goes, unless there's some plan design element that's driving them somewhere else and steering them somewhere else. And so I think often physicians, you know, they're trying to do right by their patients, but they don't realize like, you know, that patient could get a $400 MRI or that patient could get a $2,800 MRI. And that could be the difference between paying the mortgage this year or this month when that guy has a $3,000 deductible.
Yeah, no, so, it's critical.
You know, that's the end of things for him, right? That you just like destroyed him financially for the next 6 months or longer. And so we don't think about that, right? But that kind of stress, that kind of anxiety could be causing all kinds of more medical problems as the inflammation builds and the glucose is released into the bloodstream and like all these problems that you're trying to save him from, you just exacerbated.
In healthcare, it's often that these conceptual shifts, as you alluded to, don't become meaningful until there's enforcement, until there's some action on the theory itself. I know this is a bit of an unfair question, but I think you would be best of all to answer this. What would enforcement look like should the federal government come down on an employer entity or a fiduciary entity? What would that hammer look like?
Well, what it typically looks like, what it has looked like prior to now, is it's rare that DOJ is going to come and just charge a plan sponsor, like an employer, with violating its fiduciary obligations and send them to federal prison, although they could. Usually what happens is, because there are criminal liabilities as well as civil, usually what happens is DOJ has uncovered some sort of fraud scheme, and so they're already going after a plan sponsor for some sort of fraud or gross mismanagement, negligence, wiretapping, wire violations, and which is basically any financial transaction across state lines. And so, you know, they get them on that, and then they throw in the ERISA fiduciary of violations as well, and just kind of adds to their charges and their sentencing. Where I think DOJ and Congress and DOL, Department of Labor, have started to move and signal that they're going to be going is that they're not just going to be coming after plan sponsors in this way. They're going to be going after the other plan solutions. And let me give you an example. There's a couple ways. So you could be gone after for ERISA violations, sure. But DOJ is also going after anti-competitive collusion as well and anti-competitive practices under the Sherman Antitrust Act. So just recently, DOJ as well teamed up with the Ohio State Attorney General's Office. They just sued a giant system there called Ohio Health for violating anti-competitive rules. And, you know, this was just because of contract provisions in their network contracts that they negotiate with all the networks in that in the town of Columbus, Ohio, which is the state capital. And they basically said, we see you, Ohio Health, that like you own all the hospitals in the rural areas. Okay, there aren't any others. But you also have hospitals in the city center, and there are lots of other options there. Okay, so if I'm a network, and that could be either like a carrier or I could be a plan sponsor, and I'm building my network or I'm like renting one on behalf of my plan. Any plan sponsor has to follow network adequacy rules. Okay, so that means they have to have those rural hospitals in their network, right? In outside of Columbus. In Columbus, they don't have to. So they could go with some other hospital in your network, and Ohio Health would be out of network in Columbus. That's what a lot of the networks wanted to do. Why? Because Ohio Health is more expensive and their quality is garbage, okay? And so they wanted to keep Ohio Health out of network in Columbus, but they had to have them outside. Well, Ohio Health put into their contracts with both plan sponsors and the networks, no. If you have us in the rural areas, you have to have us in network in the city center too. Well, that's anti-competitive. Basically, that's called an anti-tiering provision in their contract, and it's not allowed. Anti-steering, anti-tiering, these are anti-competitive provisions. And so if you're a physician and your practice or your facility is entering into network contracts that say something like, you have to put all our physicians under this contract if you want any of our physicians under this contract, I would argue that is illegal. At least DOJ is arguing it's illegal. We'll see. It's going to play out.
That's a really interesting point that you make, because you're now redefining network in a primarily fiduciary terms, as right. opposed to what many clinicians would have naturally assumed to be a clinical network. And I think that's an important word to harp on, because in many ways you have really emphasized what's called a post-network framework. Mm-hmm. For the listening audience who may have some understanding on your leadership in this space, talk a little bit about the definition of post-network as you have explained it many other times, but then also talk a little bit about this cognitive shift in what a network is at a much more fundamental level, because I think that's really important for the listening audience to understand.
Yeah, I think a lot of physicians think about a network as, like you said, a clinically integrated network or an ACO or something like that, but really, all a network is, when you're talking about carrier networks, right? Blue Cross, Aetna network, a local regional network, all that is, the only real product that they're selling is their set of direct contracts with you, the physicians. That's it. So they have contracted rates with a bunch of physicians and practices and hospitals and labs and everyone else. And that's what they're selling, is access to those discounted rates, okay? Off-bill charges. Now, this alone is like a weird anomaly that's only attributable to healthcare. Like, out in the world, there's no like build charges and I buy access to some discount. Like, no, there's just a price. Yeah. So you don't need networks because there's just a price. But in healthcare, of course, there's fake prices, these sticker prices, but they're not always fake. I once had Marty McCary talk to who's now FDA commissioner. He once said that when he was at Johns Hopkins, he asked them, why do we even have this charge master and this bill charges list price? Like, why do we even do that if it's fake, you know? And when I was a staffer, I would get lobbied by the hospitals and I'd say, look at your horrible list prices. And they'd say, nobody ever charges that. Like, don't worry about that. Don't worry your pretty head about those sticker prices, Katie, because nobody ever is charged that. But Marty said that Johns Hopkins, when he asked the question, said, well, Marty, sometimes a Saudi sheikh walks in the door. And so, like, they actually do charge that price to some people. And so they have to have it, I guess. Anyway, so given all the charge master list prices, all that Blue Cross is selling the world of employers is access to contracted discounted rates, meaning my patient walks in with a Blue Cross logo, hands that to you, and you know you're going to get paid and exactly how much. I mean, in theory, right? Yeah. After you put it in some algorithm that you probably had to pay $100,000 for. So you know how much you're going to get paid, right? And therefore, you take the patient. You let them schedule. Because if you don't have a contract and you don't know what you're going to get paid, well, lots of times you won't even schedule the patient, which is another issue that I think Congress should step in on. So this is what a network is. So when we start to think about what is a life, you know, outside a network or a post-network world, what I'm really talking about is post these carrier networks, right? That doesn't mean that I, as a plan sponsor or an employer, am not presenting what kind of sounds like a network to my patients, because I'm going to have what I call a tier zero, a tier on my network that's like totally free to the members. If you go to this place, it's no cost to you. If you go to that place, you're going to pay your deductible and coinsurance, okay? So that's like tier zero versus tier one, two, three, depending on how much I want to charge people. Okay. So a true post-network world would not have any of that. It would just be like, go wherever you want and we'll just pay cash, or we'll directly contract with those places and we'll do a single case agreement, or we'll do a universal case agreement, and they'll just submit the bill to the plan afterwards. Or it'll be something like what's called reference-based pricing, which physicians hate hospitals hate, but lots of plans are doing it because they're desperate. And I have one plan that we use this methodology with, and it has lots of problems. There are trade-offs. The pros are that you save a lot of money. The cons are that you have trouble getting appointments. And the reason is that we basically have an allowable amount that the plan will pay. It's a certain percentage above Medicare rate. And we send our patients in, they get the care, the plan is billed, the plan pays that allowable rate. And if you don't like it, well, that's too bad for you. You just charge the patient the rest, is typically what happens. And then the patient has this big balance bill and they're either unhappy or they send that balance bill to the plan. And we then call you and we're like, okay, we see that you didn't like our rate. Let's talk about what you would like and would accept in order to leave this patient alone. And so that's how those sort of totally no network plans work today. I would argue that's not a great solution because it puts the patients in the middle of two parties that do not, the buyer and the seller of care, that do not have a contract with each other. And the patient is like left to hang out to dry until we resolve our dispute, mm-hmm. if we have one. And so the patient could be going to collections. They could be, you know, seeing credit score problems. If our dispute takes a long time to resolve and you put them into collections, even because you don't like me or you don't think you're going to get paid or whatever. So that happens all the time. And worse, that's sort of like noise that happens after the care has been delivered. What I think I can solve for that, because I can get good vendors and good partners that can negotiate with you well and pay you in reasonable ways. And so I can usually eliminate that balance billing problem if I work hard and find a good vendor, which I have done. But the real reason I detest reference-based pricing plans is because if my patient walks in with an ID card that does not have a network logo on it, you, the doctor, are like, I don't take this plan. I'm not contracted for anything with this plan. Like, I don't know if I'm going to get paid or what I'm going to get paid. And so your front desk people, they have no idea what this plan is. They've never heard of a self-funded plan. They've never heard of a reference-based pricing plan. They don't know what this is. It's not in their drop-down menu. And so they just say, we don't take your plan. No appointment is offered. Mm-hmm. And so I don't like that. It creates upfront friction, which I can solve the after the fact friction. The upfront friction is a massive problem for patients. Then they're calling me, they're calling the plan like, I can't get my appointment, or they cancel my appointment after they tried to call my insurance. Like, all this chaos ensues. So I really hate that. So then the question becomes, well, what else can we do? Like, what mm-hmm. otherwise we're just stuck. So I would argue that between like that and zero network option and the like, we're all just on the carrier plantation option, there are these like steps in between, okay? One of the steps is tiered, right? How do I have a tier zero and then the carrier network becomes my tier two or tier three or whatever? But my tier zero is going to be preferred providers that either are willing to take cash from me on behalf of the patient, either day of service or before the date of service, or even after service, like whatever, I'll call you up and pay you with a credit card, right? Willing to take cash. Or they're willing to do a contract with me for the plan for all my enrollees. And we're going to then, so instead of billing the network, instead of sending that claim to the network, even though there's a network logo on that card, you send the claim to this independent third-party administrator who pays you after the fact. So, and they're going to pay you rather than repricing that claim according to your network contract, which you have, or maybe you don't if you're an out-of-network provider, they're going to pay you according to our contracted rate. Yeah. Okay. So
that makes sense.
If I'm in a local market, like I've got a Catholic diocese who is my employer client, they're localized, right? They don't have employees all over the place. They're localized. That means I'm going to basically find the best doctors and hospitals that are all independent. They're not in some giant corporate conglomerations. And I'm going to go around. I'm going to find the highest quality ones who are willing to do these disruptive agreements. And we're going to turn all those providers into a tier zero, where if my members go to my plan members go to you, they pay nothing. You don't have to chase them. And therefore, because you don't have to chase them for cost sharing, you're going to get, and you're going to get paid well. And maybe you're going to get paid the same day. You're going to give me a great rate, a great cash rate, or a great lower price rate. Okay. And we're going to work together and we're going to create that little tier zero network, even though we have a network, a carrier network on the plan. Here's the problem with this. The networks put provisions into their contract with you, the doctor, and to their contract with me, the plan, saying we can't do this. That if my patient walks in with a carrier logo, you have to bill that network for that claim, for that patient. And so there are a lot of like schemes that are springing up to avoid this, meaning we don't send, maybe we don't send the patient in with an ID card. Maybe we send them with a voucher saying, proving to your front desk that we already paid cash for you, or to call this number and we'll pay you cash right now. So these are some of the, like, there are vendors out there that are providing this type of service, or they'll help you pay cash. But I actually think that what Congress needs to do, I would argue that these anti-tiering, anti-steering provisions in your contract with these carriers and the plan's contract with the carriers are illegal. And yeah. I would argue that they should be unenforceable, and that Congress or DOL should either by law or by regulation outlaw them in practice.
No, I learned a lot about the tiering structure by looking at the All Better website and learning a lot about some of the modeling that you guys have done. And I think it might be very helpful for the listening audience to go through some case studies, but I want to structure the level of understanding to first focus more on the conceptual basis and then get into the case studies, because I think that'll be really helpful. As you alluded to, employers are trying different models, whether that's direct contracting, bundling, alternative access. It all seems logical, as you're explaining, to the employer, given the limited information. And a lot of these things, they seem iteratively possible. Like, okay, well, if we try this model, and then we try grouping the patients in this way, and we try grouping the fiduciary model in this manner, it might make sense. Talk a little bit about the landmines and the pitfalls that a lot of employers go through as they're trying to stepwise build up their plan without having a concrete understanding of everything that entails.
Yeah, I mean, they can't do it. Like, their HR department is not equipped to do this. They're, you know, good at hiring people and recruiting people and, you know, putting together life insurance options and whatever. But like building this type of unbundled health plan and negotiating the contracts with all these plan solutions and all the providers in a way that doesn't violate fiduciary problems, like that smokes out those anti-competitive provisions in contracts and knows how to, they can't do this. And so it's critical that they hire a benefits advisor that does know how to do it. And there are a few hundred of us out there. We're sort of in a tribe called Health Rosetta. That's one easy way to find a benefits advisor like that. There's like a tribe of fiduciary-minded benefits advisors who have no conflicts of our own. Because one of the most conflicted industries is the benefits advisor industry. So the first conflict of interest you have to overcome if you're an employer is your broker. And there are a few big brokerage houses, and their business model relies on kickbacks from every solution that they recommend to employers. And if you don't give them a kickback, you don't get recommended to employers. Yeah. But they're marketing themselves as the employer's agent. Literally, we have agent licenses. We are licensed agents. And so we're supposed to be agents of the buyer of services, not agents of the seller, when in fact, the seller is the one that's primarily paying us, whether it's the carrier, the stop-loss insurer, the point solution, the wellness vendor, the PBM. Like, all those actors are paying traditional brokers And so the first thing an employer has to do is like fire their traditional broker, truly. And Congress really helped with this with a law that I helped work on in 2020, the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2021. It basically requires all independent benefit, it requires not independent, all benefits advisors to provide all their direct and indirect compensation to disclose that to employers who ask for it. But lots of employers don't even know to ask.
Yeah. And I think that goes to the concept of governance structure that I think you really have a core competency in. Perhaps talk a little bit about when you're restructuring employer health plans and you're really getting into the weed of things, like navigation infrastructure and data warehousing. What are the governance considerations that you really need to weed out from the very beginning as you start to tease out this model? Because it's one of those kind of unknown unknowns, to kind of quote Donald Rumsfeld, that I think you really highlighted many places. And I think it's important to let the listening audience know that governance structure is a very unique phenomenon in this space.
Yeah, so it's really important, first and foremost, the most like fundamental governance principle is you have to own your data. And most employers don't, and they don't even know how to go about doing that. And even if they did own it, like what they would do with it. So you have to make sure that in all your contracts, you own the data. Now, lots of carriers and some PBMs, the big PBMs, will not actually concede in a contract that you own your data. They will give you access to it under certain terms and conditions that they have to agree to. And so you have to get those contracts out, those contract provisions out, and you can't with the big guys. And so you're going to have to fire them. But even though, like, literally in law, in that same Consolidated Appropriations Act, it says, like, plans have to be able to own their data. But that has not really translated into actual behavior change among these giant corporations because they don't need your business. I've got like 5,000 lives here in this like Kansas City or wherever. And they don't, Cigna, Blue Cross, they don't need my business. They, you know, they're a $1 trillion company. You know, if you look at like United. So they're not going to like negotiate a contract with you and like, you're not going to be able to redline their contracts and their lawyers are going to be like, okay, let's compromise. Like, no, they're just going to say, take it or leave it. And so I had one employer while they were their client, but while they were still a prospect and I was like, you know, in the process of working with them to close the deal, I was reviewing, I did a fiduciary review of their PBM and carrier contract. It was all one because of course it's the same PBM and carrier. And I reviewed it and I found like 47 different fiduciary violations in their contract. And I went to the HR person who was a 30-year veteran, probably the best, most buttoned-up HR person I've ever seen. And I'm like, what you doing here, you know? And she said, what do you expect me to do? You know, like, I can't go to this carrier and say, I can't have these 20 things, you know? They're just going to walk away. And then what? When you've got thousands of employees, you can't just like lose your carrier network, you know? And so it's really, really tricky. So first, you have to make sure that you own your data. And often the only way to do that is to use an independent third-party administrator instead of letting the carrier administer your plan. Just rent your network from the carrier and have an independent administrator company administer the plan, meaning they're the ones that pay the claims. They're the ones that, you know, like do all the eligibility and all the stuff for the member. They run the member portal. They coordinate all the vendors. They do all the invoicing. They're administering the plan. Okay. And so your contract's with them, right? And they are the keeper because they're paying the claims. They have all your claims. And so you can get your claims out of them. And then separately, house your claims with an independent data warehouse and analytics firm. So you don't know how to like run all the analytics to like answer any questions about your data that you might have. So you want an analytics firm to have access to all your data in real time and to be able to answer questions for you when you need to control costs or understand what the drivers of cost are, what the drivers of risk are in your population. So owning your data is critical. And that means audit rights. You have to look for audit rights. They have to be unlimited, basically, and none of them ever are. But okay, so another principle, obviously, is you want to look for independent ownership in your vendors. So I like to look for whether it's a PBM, whether it's a navigation company or a point solution or anything. I don't want private equity owning my partners if I can avoid it. Sometimes you can't avoid it. But if I can avoid it, I want it to be like a privately held, family-owned company that's trying to leave their company to their grandkids, you know, and that really considers our client, our shared client, to be, you know, equally important to them as they are to me, you know. And so, and I want to be able to call the leadership of that company on a weekend when there's a problem. So looking for smaller, independently owned companies that aren't so small that they can't handle, you know, your scale. So it's tricky to find the right vendors out there. And vendor vetting is probably one of the most critical pieces of this. Finding mission aligned vendors that actually agree with all these principles and are like on board with this mission to save and disrupt healthcare as the broken status quo. They're out there and they kind of assemble at certain conferences. So you can find them. They're out there. But there are a lot of like really well-intentioned vendors that don't execute in terms operationally as well. So it's tricky. You got to really check references and, you know, you make mistakes along the way and you switch vendors and it's hard. There are trade-offs to this. There are member disruption issues and physicians get mad because you just switch vendors that they used to send their bills to. And, you know, there's trade-offs to this unbundled style. And really the benefits advisor that you have hired becomes the quarterback of all these, you know, moving parts to try to make it feel as seamless an experience for the members. And that's very hard to do.
It just sounds insurmountable, but in practice is probably even much more difficult. I want to transition and maybe talk in more practical terms about specific examples. One of the points that you had mentioned earlier in the conversation was about this tiered structuring. I want to talk a little bit more about how that can help employers. Can you maybe start by giving maybe what would you describe as kind of the classic case study that really informs how you can help employers?
Yeah, I'd love to talk about kind of the gold standard in our like little tribe of like-minded benefits advisors. We all kind of look to a particular case study, a particular model that has been around for decades, which is why we all kind of model ourselves after it. And it's the example of the Rosen Hotels. Harris Rosen just passed away this past year or maybe the year prior. A lovely, lovely man. And he owned a chain of hotels and resorts in the mid-Florida region, in Orlando primarily. And, you know, thousands and thousands of employees, lots of blue-collar workers, lots of people with lots of sick problems, sicknesses, and joint pain. You know, they've got, like, janitors and landscapers and housekeepers and just all kinds of people who have very low wage and are doing back-breaking work a lot of times. And they had all kinds of health problems. What they did is they fired their network and they started paying a reference-based price, but they did it by talking to the local hospitals and they started, you know, contracting with the local hospitals. And then they built a clinic on site, and that was a direct primary care clinic, and it was totally free to all the members and employees and their families to get unlimited amount of care. And they got to know their doctors, and that really kept them out of urgent care, kept them out of emergency rooms, kept them out of unnecessary specialist tracks. And over time, they added services to that clinic, such as mental health and physical therapy and all the kinds of things that you really want people to avail themselves of these types of services because it prevents so much downstream chaos later. And then they added a pharmacy. So now they're actually dispensing drugs out of that clinic, at cost drugs. They're not trying to make a profit. They're just trying to like save money on the cost of them. So they're buying them in bulk. They're dispensing them there. And then they brought in sort of, mobility experts to do stretches with their, landscapers and their housekeeping staff. And they taught them how to do just little stretches throughout the day. And they reduced their lower back incidents by like double digits in the first year of this. And so the employees then over time, they saved so much money that over time the deductibles and the premiums went down to almost nothing. So the employees pay like $100 a year or some ridiculous amount of money. And the plan itself, you would think, well, now the plan's taking on all these costs. No, the plan itself over time saved so much money by realigning the incentives of all their plan partners to comport with their incentives, which is healthier people at lower cost. They saved so much money over time that Harris Rosen set up a foundation, and he basically created educational opportunities through charities in that entire local region in Orlando, such that everyone in their neighborhood could go to college if they wanted to for free. And they started a tutoring program so that they took a massive dropout rate to almost zero in their community. So they spent millions and millions of dollars starting in the, like, I think 1980s, when they over these decades improving their community, reinvesting that value. Because remember, what these giant insurance conglomerates do, these giant corporate Wall Street-owned conglomerates, is they suck value out of your local community and send it to Wall Street. Mm-hmm. And so when you can actually work with the providers in your community, the doctors, the hospitals, and you can keep people there and you can keep the healthcare there, and then you keep the dividends of the savings there too, and it's reinvested in the economy and in people's futures, it is the most beautiful example that we all kind of model ourselves after.
No, that's amazing. It's quite rare in this day and age to see somebody kind of take that approach. And I think that with the corporate landscape being what it is, very much taken over by the private equity worlds, the venture capital worlds, you see a misalignment in the incentive structure. The tiering model that you had mentioned before helps to address a lot of these trends that you're seeing in the employer health world. Talk a little bit about the tiering model using a specific case study, because I think that that'd be very interesting for people to hear.
Yeah, so typically in a plan like this, it's not that you're making people choose certain providers and certain care pathways. It's that you're incentivizing them to, and you're helping navigate them to that. So one of the really important aspects of any of these plans is that they don't work if you don't have a navigator. So some plans have navigators that are like just normal, well-informed people, kind of like me. Other plans have nurse navigators. So we usually put nurse navigators on our plans, because if you want to fight the white coat influence sending you to the hospital that owns that doctor, then you have to basically, there is no other profession in America that is more trusted than a physician, except a nurse. So if you put a nurse on the plan, they will listen to the nurse too. So you basically create options for people. You say, here, we create a benefit structure such that you can get almost all of your healthcare free if you follow either the navigator's advice or the tier. You go to the tier zero providers. And, you know, when you're talking about housekeepers, landscapers, minimum wage, or, you know, working class people, like, that makes a huge difference. Yeah. And so, you know, we've got a trucking company that was so sick when we took them over. The amount of diabetes in this, like, and obesity in these metabolic disorders in this group of like middle-aged men that sit on their butts all day driving trucks for like 14 hours at a time, you know, they were sick as you can be. Mm-hmm. And they had delayed care and delayed care. They're never home to get care. And so they were really, really sick. And so when you're talking about people who don't have a lot of resources and they have huge healthcare needs, this is the only way to not go bankrupt.
Yeah. I think this notion of incentive structure is critical to helping align the healthcare system within a framework of low cost, keep the patient healthy. What are some employer restructuring examples you can give in which you worked with an employer to then focus the alignment on healthy, low cost patients?
Yeah. So essentially, let me give you an example here in my hometown. We have an employer of about 1,500 employees, and they were using Cigna. They were contracted with a carrier. Cigna was actually running their plan. Okay. Now, Cigna owns Express Scripts as the PBM. And so, of course, Express Scripts was their PBM. So it was this fully bundled plan, the entire plantation, everything is done by this one company. And so we get in there and we keep Cigna on the plan. We rent their network, but we fire Cigna as the plan administrator. We definitely fired Express Scripts, and we used a fiduciary. They put the fiduciary status into their contract, transparent PBM. And we put that on the plan because, of course, drug costs are driving so much spend for employers. And when we change PBMs, about half of the savings that we achieve for employers is from drug costs. So it's amazing how much, I mean, it's amazing how much you can save on drugs, because there's no way that I can look at an Express Scripts contract. Like, I reviewed that Express Scripts contract and I found a lot of problems. But there's no way that I could, like, even find all the problems, much less negotiate them away, right? Mm-hmm. I can't negotiate them away. I won't even find the problems. They're thinking of, like, ways to screw my client that I haven't even imagined yet, right? So there's nothing you can do except fire them. So you fire them, okay. Year one, drug costs went down by 37%. And that's in the context of GLP-1s. That's, like, this past year. And so it's in the context of, like, dramatically rising health costs. And then also what we do is, like, now we have this independent plan administrator. And so medical costs went down as well. Where we're seeing in our local community, we're seeing, you know, renewal rates of double digits. Most employers are getting rate hikes of double digits. Ours did not. We, like, kept well under trend. The medical costs. So it's really, really dramatic. And, you know, I had one little group of Catholic nuns that I work with, and we put them on a no network plan. Their absolute top priority was saving money because they raise all their costs for paying their medical bills from donors and benefactors. And so we put them, they were spending about, I want to say $900,000 a year. In the first year, we saved them 40%. And it's been the same year over year. They have saved, you know, in 5 or 6 years of being in this kind of plan, they have saved probably $5 million. It's just shocking.
Yeah. I think another stakeholder that we have to take into account, which you have alluded to in many points, but I want to talk more directly, would be the physicians or the physician operators, the clinical groups that would partner with the employer, partner with the plans that you're structuring. What key focus should they maintain? How should they approach this conversation with the mutual understanding that aligns with the employers and the health package writ large?
Yeah, let's talk about primary care first, and then I'll talk about specialists and other ancillary providers. So primary care, you know, it's I'm sure you've had episodes on this. It's, like, totally broken. You get 7-minute visits. It takes you 6 weeks to get an appointment. You go in, there's, like, bulletproof glass. You have to fill out a form and all this paperwork that you just filled out, like, 6 months ago. Nothing's changed. It's the same you. And then they call you back and you tell your story to some, you know, tech and who's weighing you and taking your BP. And then they put you in an exam room. You tell your story again to some nurse who's asking your story. And you're like, I guess you didn't hear it from the tech. And then she tells you to get naked. You're sitting on freezing in some paper napkin on the exam table. And then, you know, the physician comes in, hasn't heard your story. What's your story? And it takes you 6 minutes to get your story out. And then on average, you get 7 minutes with them. And so if your problem will be solved that day, only if you can have a drug prescribed for you in less than a minute. Okay. And that drug will cure you. So if that drug will cure you and it can get written on that little scratch pad and put into the EHR in 1 minute, then you're going to walk away happy that day. Everyone else gets referred to some high price revenue stream somewhere down the street at the local hospital system, and or just to more specialists. And those primary care docs who are trained to manage 80% of all your needs, they're referring you out instead for all your needs because they don't have time in that 1 minute or the 7 minutes to, like, tell you why you have lower back pain or why you can't sleep or, you know, why your glucose keeps spiking or, you know, why the inhalers aren't working. Like, they don't have time for that. So they just refer you to a specialist. And that is not why any of them went to medical school, to, like, just be a high price referral factory. And, you know, so they're all burned out. They hate their lives. So obviously, primary care docs, we love to make their day. We love to go into them and say, hey, if I could bring you 1,000 patients and I would pay you whether you see them or not, and all you have to do is keep them out of the emergency room and urgent care and out of specialty practices, what do you say? I'm going to pay you every month. And they love it. And many of them who are already in direct primary care, they have buddies who are still in the system who have wanted to get out, but they haven't had the volume to justify hiring their buddy. And so we give them that chance to hire their buddy. And so direct primary care physicians are our best allies, absolutely our best allies. We make their lives better. They make our patients better. And it's really beautiful. I was just at an open enrollment meeting with one of our client employers, and the DPC doctor that we put on the plan was at the meeting, and she was in the back. And so no one knew she was there yet. I hadn't introduced her. And several of the patients got up and started raving, gushing about how this woman had saved their lives and had like cured their things that had been going on forever and really listened to them and had all this time and really cared about them. And like the doctor's bursting into tears in the back. And, you know, it was so beautiful. And like, this is why they went to medical school, is to practice mm-hmm. this way. Okay, so that's the physician. The first thing, like, you got to put primary care on the plan. It's your only hope for solving downstream costs. Okay, when it comes to specialty practices, we love to partner with independently owned specialty practices. Obviously, I'm going to contract with hospitals because I want to and we need to, and especially the ones that are local in our communities and aren't owned by some giant conglomerate. So we definitely will partner with hospitals, but we much prefer to partner with every possible type of specialty practice in the community that has an independently owned version of itself. So whether that's ortho or cardio or OBGYN or all, we want to find who are the independents out there, and we go out there and we ask them, you want to partner with us? And it's a little bit tricky, you know, like making this work. Okay, where do I send the bills and how do I get paid and what do I collect from the patients? And they're very confused by this. But typically what we'll say is you collect nothing from the patients if they come to you, or we just do a bundle care bundles and that are all in. So, or we just pay them a percent of Medicare that we negotiate with them that works for them. Often they end up like the overall price that the employer is paying is lower than they would have paid under a network contract, but the amount the doctor's getting is higher than if they were charging the network. So because that's just when you take all the profiteering out of the relationship and bloat and hidden conflicts of interest and kickbacks, like all of a sudden everyone else is doing better. So it's a win-win for the buyers and the sellers of care. And we really, really like to do that. And we do the same thing with imaging facilities, labs. We love independent labs. We love independent pharmacies for the same reason.
Yeah, no, this has been extremely enlightening, and your focus on supporting the independent stakeholders in the care continuum is extremely important. I'd like to conclude by giving people an opportunity to follow up with you. For those of you who are interested in learning more, check out katietalento.com. It's an extremely engaging website. I would also encourage you to go to the All Better Health website as well to learn about their care modeling. Much of what we discussed in this conversation came from concepts that were on that website. So I would encourage you to check out both of the websites. But for those of you who may be interested in partnering, perhaps from the employer standpoint or from the clinical operator standpoint, what's the best way that they can get a hold of you?
Yeah, they should reach out to me through the website at allbetter.health. We have like a contact form. Please reach out to me. We definitely want to hear from you. We do have clients that are nationwide. So probably wherever you are, we might have a need to partner with you. So we'd love to see that. And certainly if you're an employer that has enough employees that you could self-fund, which is usually 50 or more, 70 or more, you can usually self-fund, then give us a call and we'd love to partner with you.
All right, Katie, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.